I'm Vermont Edition producer Daniela Fierro, popping in to say we've edited this podcast a little for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Michaela LaFrac. When we consider the career of former Vermont Governor Madeleine Cunin, it's tempting to focus on the firsts, and they are significant. Madeleine Cunin was the first and to date still the only woman elected to serve as governor in the Green Mountain State, winning her first term in 1984. She's also the first and only Jewish person to serve as Vermont's governor, and the first woman to be elected to three gubernatorial terms in any state in the country. But there is much more to the story of Cunin's career, what she accomplished during her time in office, what came after when she was appointed as ambassador to Switzerland, and the influence her historic leadership had on an entire generation of women. It's a thread that can be followed right up to 2 years ago, when Becca Ballant was elected for the first time as Vermont's first and to date only female congressional representative. That election, by the way, also wiped out the ignominious distinction Vermont held as being the only state that had never elected a woman to serve in Congress. When you add to all this being the author of numerous books, including two published poetry collections, the most recent of which, Walk With Me, came out last year, there is a deep wellspring to explore when speaking about Vermont's first woman governor. And that's why we are delighted to have Madeleine Cunin herself with us today on Vermont Edition. Governor, thank you so much for being here.
It's a delight to be here. Thank you.
I want to talk about first. Well, actually, let me let people know you can call in and join this conversation. I'm so excited to get started with you. I have to remind listeners they can be a part of this as well. Give us a call if you have any questions for Governor Cunin at 1-800-639-2211. You can also send an email to Vermont Edition at vermontpublic.org. The phone lines are open at 800-639-2211. You started out as a journalist at the Burlington Free Press back in the early 70s, and I'm wondering when you decided that you wanted to be involved in politics. Was there a pivotal moment?
Well, there wasn't a pivotal moment, but I think the women's movement gave me the idea that women could do anything, and I wanted to be involved in public events, and being in Vermont, politics seemed more accessible, and we had a small group of people at that time who encouraged each other to do things larger than their personal lives, and I took that seriously.
You did. And, you know, for our younger listeners who may not be familiar with the U.S. political landscape in 1984 when you were first elected, this was a time when conservative politics was cemented in power under Ronald Reagan. He'd swept to a landslide second-term victory over Democrat Walter Mondale. The political map was still very much male-dominated as well. I'm wondering if your candidacy for Vermont governor was viewed at the time as a long-shot bid.
Well, it probably was, but I tried to ignore that. And actually, there was a female governor in Connecticut, I think Ella Grasso. And when I campaigned in southern Vermont, somebody would say to me, "You want to be another Ella?" So thank goodness for Ella. And she helped unknowingly pave the way for me.
I'd like to read a passage from your book, Coming of Age, in which you talk about some of the specific things that a man running for office did not have to consider. And this deals with just with how you were told to dress at the time. Nothing to do with policy or ideas, anything like that. You write, "The message was, don't stand out. I was on a teeter-totter, not too feminine and not too masculine, just enough of each gender to look like a real governor, parentheses male, and still be true to myself, parentheses, female. The test you wrote is authenticity. Too masculine, and I would be aloof or cold. Too feminine, and I would be too soft and weak." 40 years later, Madeleine Cunin, all that has changed, right?
It has changed, and yet it hasn't.
Yeah.
And you look at Kamala Harris. She wore the same style suit every day, but different colors, but the suit looked like a man's suit. So I think any woman who's running for high office or executive office has to be that in-between person, masculine enough to reassure people that she won't be unusual, but feminine enough to be a convincing woman. It's a very fine line, and it varies with each person. I think Kamala did it pretty well.
Did you resent at the time that you had to consider those things, or did you think of it, look, this is just part of the game that I have to play if I want to reach the highest office in Vermont?
Yeah, I think the latter. I think I had to play the game. And I had good advisors, but, you know, some things were odd. Like one person called the campaign office and said they didn't like my gray stockings. Huh. And fashionable stockings were au courant. So I had to go back to neutral stockings. So, and my hair was a big topic of conversation. When I cut my hair, everybody noticed. When I didn't cut it, everybody noticed.
Everybody noticed those things. Once you did become governor, you had an opportunity to bring other talented and qualified women into government. And this included appointing the first woman to Vermont's Supreme Court, Denise Johnson. Molly Beattie, I believe, as well, was appointed to the Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation. She would go on to become the first woman director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Was there much resistance at the time to any of these decisions?
No, there really wasn't. I mean, I was very fortunate in the fact that a lot of women had come into their prime when I was governor, and I took some chances. Molly Beattie, who unfortunately died too young, but she turned out to be a terrific appointee, though she confessed to me later that for our interview, she had to buy the first dress that she'd worn for many years.
No kidding. That's something. We are speaking with former Governor Madeline Cunin. If you would like to join this conversation, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also send an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. And we have received some emails already from some folks who wanted to write in and express some gratitude to you. It looks like Marnie from Middlebury writes, in part, in 1990, as part of a group organized by the Children's Art Exchange of Middlebury, planning to visit the former Soviet Union, Governor Cunin hosted a portion of us in her office. She had personally invited five additional Vermonters to join our travel group in order to broaden our trip locations to include Vermont's sister state of Karelia in the Soviet Union. And we had an unbelievable trip, says Marnie, which extended our horizons by sharing personal contacts with Soviet citizens during that particular time in world history. She says, thank you, Governor Cunin, for all that you have accomplished on behalf of others. You've definitely left your mark.
Well, that's very nice. I remember that. And we established this sister state with Karelia, and we took a chance as I look back. It was December, and it was cold in Karelia. And we did what you couldn't unfortunately do now. We did establish real friendships with the leaders of Karelia, and they paid a return visit to Vermont. I wonder now what happened to those people, if they're still active.
Oh, I hope so. You know, after you were governor of Vermont, later Bill Clinton in 1996 appointed you to be ambassador to Switzerland. That's where you were born. I'm not sure how many people are aware of that. Being born in Switzerland, of course, precluded you from ever running for president. And I've always been curious to ask you this question, Governor. Had you been born in the United States, would you ever have considered a run for the presidency?
Well, that's a tough question, which fortunately I didn't have to consider because I had this ready-made excuse of not being born in the United States. The answer is I don't know. Probably not. I mean, I'm leaning towards no, but who knows?
I was just curious, and I had to ask. I hope that's okay. I want to talk a little bit more about your being born in Switzerland, because this was a decision. You were born there, and then your mother left Switzerland because she was worried at the time that the Nazis would invade. Is that right? I mean, talk a little bit about your background.
Well, yes. I was almost 6 years old when we came to America in 1940, and I couldn't speak a word of English. But as a child, you learn it very quickly, and I wanted to be American. But my mother instilled in me and my brother, Edgar May, who was my big brother, 4 years older, she taught us that anything is possible in America. So the American dream was very much alive in our family. And I think if anything made me run for politics, for governor, for legislator, it was my mother's idealism, which was transferred to us.
She must have been a very strong woman. That's a hard thing to do, to move your family from one country to another, especially at a time when the world is in such turmoil.
Yes, as I grow older, my gratitude to her increases. She was very brave. And my father died when I was very young. I was 3 years old. So she was a widow with two children. For us as children, it was all a big adventure. We looked at it as a wonderful time. And I played shuffleboard on board the ship. And so it was fun. I didn't know that there were Nazi German ships and submarines in the waters that we were crossing.
When you were running for governor for the first time, we mentioned, of course, you were the first woman governor, the first Jewish governor as well. How was Vermont as far as it went for you being a Jew? Was there anti-Semitism that you encountered here, or did you have a lot of support?
No, I didn't encounter anti-Semitism, fortunately. The only incident that happened was a reporter called my chief of staff, Liz Bankowski, who was and is wonderful. And the reporter asked, what do you do about the three barriers that Madeleine Kuhnen, she's a woman, she's a Democrat, and she's Jewish. And Liz killed the story.
Really?
And so I think most people didn't know I was Jewish, and the other people didn't care.
And Vermonters just voted as they would.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. You know, I mentioned Becca Ballant at the top of the show here. She is the first woman to be elected to Congress in Vermont. She's also Jewish, and she's the first openly gay woman to be elected. Do you see a thread, as I had mentioned at the top, between what you accomplished, what you did, and having her elected some 40 years later in this capacity?
There must be a thread, and I'm glad she pulled it, that she's doing well. And again, I don't think people care very much whether she's Jewish or gay, which is a credit to our state.
We got this email from Dean, who writes, I just wanted to thank Governor Kuhnen for all she has done for our state and nation. Governor Kuhnen went to the school of my daughters for some occasion. They were honored to be able to hear and meet her. Governor Kuhnen inspired them throughout her career and encouraged them to be involved in their communities and to believe they could be whatever they hoped to be. Governor Kuhnen helped make my children leaders in their careers and engaged in projects improving their communities. Dean, thank you for that. That must feel nice to hear.
Yes, it is. Thank you very much.
And of course, if you'd like to send in your own email or any thoughts or questions you have for Governor Kuhnen, vermontedition@vermontpublic.org is the way to do that, or you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Governor Kuhnen, one of the things that you did as ambassador to Switzerland was to create with Swiss banks a compensation fund for Holocaust survivors. And I wonder if that was always a goal when you accepted that job, or did it come about in another way?
No, it wasn't my goal. But the minute that I was announced, I got a small briefing in Washington about the question of Jewish assets in Swiss banks. And when I got to Switzerland, it came up every single day that I was in office. And the question was Switzerland in favor of the Nazis in accepting these funds and in not returning them to the owners? There were two types of owners, those who survived the Holocaust and would come to the banks and ask for the money, and those who died with their heirs would come for the funds. And it was a pretty sensitive question, because my job as ambassador was to have a good relationship with Switzerland. And at the same time, I had to push Switzerland to come forth with these bank accounts. So it was there all the time. But in the end, we did succeed in giving some money back to the owners and publishing the accounts. But I felt somebody asked me if Clinton had asked me to do this, if he knew I was Jewish. I said, no, Clinton didn't ask me to do this. But at the end, I felt maybe I was there for a purpose. And I was happy we were able to solve the issue partly, not entirely, but some of the money was returned.
That was a bold decision because, as you say, as a diplomat, you have to straddle that line between, you know, you're representing the country, you want to have a good relationship with them. But I have to imagine that because of your background, because of you know what your mother went through and everything that happened there, that this was really important to you on a deeply personal level, too.
Yes, it was. It was on a personal level, and that's why it absorbed me. And it absorbed the news. There was no text written as to how to handle this, but I'm glad we succeeded mostly, not completely.
But at least partially, yes. Let's go to the phones. Mike is on the line from Danville. Hi, Mike.
My call, and thank you, Governor Kunin, for your service. My anecdote is that my stepfather, Francis Rip Hathorn, was the sergeant of arms or the assistant sergeant of arms for the legislature when you were inaugurated, and he was so proud to be able to introduce you to the legislature that infamous day when you came down the hall.
Thank you. Thank you. That's a nice connection. That's lovely. I appreciate it.
Mike, thank you very much for that call and that memory. And if you have any memories of Governor Kunin's time in office or would like to ask her a question, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. And we do have those lines open right now for Governor Kunin. Governor, you served as the chairwoman of the Appropriations Committee. You were the first woman to assume this role. A lot of firsts for you. I've noticed that. That seems to be a recurring theme here. In your book that came out in 2012, The New Feminist Agenda, Defining the Next Revolution for Women, Work, and Family, you wrote that you found an effective and unexpected mentor in conservative Republican Emory Hebert. Okay, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. You know, he championed you as a key Democrat on the committee, lobbied for you to become the next chair after he left to run for state treasurer. How did that relationship come about?
Well, it came about through friendship. At first, I thought he was a strong right-wing conservative. I actually even wrote a letter to the editor when I read something about him to that effect. But we respected each other, and somehow I supported his ideas now, which were reasonable. And I realized that the Appropriations Committee was the most important committee in the House because it controlled the purse strings on everything. And we became good friends. And sometimes I had to bite my tongue when I supported him. But he recommended me for the committee. Some Democrats were a little gun-shy. They thought I was too liberal, but Emory overruled them. So I have very fond memories of Emory Hebbard from Glover.
Let's go back to the lines. We have Marjorie on the line from Lowell. Hi, Marjorie. You're on with former Governor Madeline Cunin.
Oh, I'm so honored to be chosen. Thank you. I wanted to thank Governor Cunin for coming on the radio and telling young women and young men not to smoke. My daughter was in Newport in the Catholic high school, and a lot of her friends were dealing with that issue, and it was really wonderful.
Well, thank you. I'm glad.
Do you recall talking about that? About the dangers of smoking?
Maybe amnesia, but I don't recall that specific incident. Though I remember smoking was an issue. I remember going through the Rutland GE factory just when the no smoking ban had been enacted, and a woman sat in front of a machine with a sign that said, "I smoke and I vote." So that was the extent of the rebellion. But I'm glad your daughter didn't smoke. That's terrific.
Thanks for that call, Marjorie. We have Keith on the line from Westminster. Hi, Keith.
Hi.
You're on the line with Governor Cunin. Go ahead.
Hi, Governor. You and I share the same birthday.
Oh, really? September 28th?
November 4th, 1933?
1933 is correct.
Got the year right.
Okay. And you were acquainted with my wife, Belinda Gardner. I know you remember her name.
Mm-hmm.
And she had done quite a bit of work with teaching Jewish studies at Battlesbury Academy in St. Albans.
Oh, really? Terrific.
Really.
Thanks for calling.
So she was very much interested in the Holocaust and had quite a few guest speakers coming into her class concerning the Holocaust.
Oh, good. Good.
So I just wanted to say hello and thank you very much for your service.
Well, thank you for calling.
Appreciate that phone call, Keith. Thank you very much. I want to talk a little bit more about some of your early days in office. And you had mentioned Liz Bankowski as who you was brought onto your team. And I guess from Massachusetts, there was a Democratic congressman and an article in V.T. Digger. There was something that was given to you as advice, which was to never hire a woman campaign manager. Obviously, you didn't listen to that advice. You're glad you didn't.
Well, this was a big-time guy who had been involved in many campaigns, and Liz and I went to visit him, and I introduced Liz as my campaign manager, but it must have just whizzed by him. Because that was his advice, never hire a woman campaign manager. Of course, Liz was the best I could have chosen, and she still is a good friend and a good political advisor to lots of people. But it was a different world where you should have listened more to men than women. Men were the experts. But in my view, the experts were everywhere, and I appointed a lot of women who filled jobs that had always been held by men, and I took some risks. I mean, Molly Beatty was one of them. Gretchen Morse was head of human services. I mean, the list goes on. I wasn't disappointed in any of them, and after I left office, they each got positions in important organizations. And with many of the women, we meet every summer at my house and reminisce and talk also about the present.
That's wonderful to hear. Let's go back to the phone lines. We have Chip on the line from West Rutland. Hi, Chip. You're on with Governor Kunin.
Good afternoon, Governor. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good, good.
Except for the national scene.
Which we are going to get to, I promise.
I had the privilege of working for the late, great Senator Gil Godnick from Rutland.
Yes.
And he had a nickname which he fondly referred to as the Queen Bee. And I just want to see if you remembered that or knew of that. Or
I didn't know the Queen Bee, but I did know Gilly Godnick very well. He wasn't too fond of liberals. He called liberals hippies, as I recall.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you for your service. I appreciate it.
Thank you for calling.
Thanks for that call, Charles. Very much appreciate that. We are speaking with Governor Madeleine Kunin. You can join this conversation if you would like at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Governor, I wanted to ask about something you spearheaded as one of the most consequential land use laws in Vermont's history. It was called Act 200. And it passed in 1988. There's a really serious debate, as I'm sure you're aware, in Montpelier right now about whether our land use statutes are preventing the growth of needed housing development. We're in this housing crisis. And I wonder, are there aspects of Act 200 that need to be revisited, do you think? And more broadly, what kind of regulatory reforms do you think Vermont should consider as it tries to confront this housing crunch?
Well, I do applaud the legislature for trying to address the housing crisis. I wouldn't dive into the question of whether Act 200 should be revisited. There may be ways to do both, to grapple with the housing crisis and still protect Vermont in future land use. But since I'm not in the legislature and I don't know all the facts, I would urge the legislators not to give up on protecting Vermont open land, but we have to deal with the housing crisis. It's an urgent problem, not only in Burlington, but in other parts of the state.
As you know, being governor never comes without some criticism, and you did face some criticism from the environmental community during your tenure for supporting construction of a 190-mile natural gas pipeline. This was going to go from Canada to Massachusetts. It would have bisected Vermont. And you said at the time the project would help reduce the state's reliance on nuclear power. These are back in the days when Vermont Yankee was still up and running. I'm wondering if your views on energy have shifted as we've learned more about the role of carbon emissions and climate change, and would you support a similar natural gas pipeline project today?
I don't know.
That's I love the honest answer, Governor. Thank you.
That's the honest answer. I'm a strong environmentalist, and I was then, but sometimes you have to make choices, and the choices can be between two good things or two bad things. But that was 40-some years ago. I think natural gas is the best alternative, but it depends what you have to do to get it.
We've got a call now from Maxine in Montpelier. Hi, Maxine.
Hello, Governor Kunin.
Yes.
Oh, this is Maxine Leary. I don't know if you remember, back in 1984, your campaign, I ran your computer system.
Oh, yes.
And worked with your wonderful volunteers. It was such an honor, and you were so inspiring, and you still are. I just turned 95, so I'm right, you know, a little bit older, and...
Well, congratulations. When I announce that I'm 91, people congratulate me. So I'm sure you get congratulations, too. Not that we do much about getting older, but it somehow seems something you don't hide anymore, like 85. No, it's something you can brag about.
And there's such wonderful memories. And you were just so inspiring. that whole summer that I was there involved with you folks. It was just such an experience. And I want to thank you. And I want to thank you for keeping going and being out there. We thank need you.
Thank you so much.
I and can't keep on going, it. Won't you? 105, 110. How about that?
Yeah, how about that? Can you do that for
Let's
us?
Let's go.
No, thank you.
No,
go
thank
for
you.
It. Another young honest children answer. Come right along behind us.
Maxine, thank you so much for that phone
call.
I very much appreciate that, Maxine. Thank you so much. I love these honest answers, too, that we're getting. We got this email from Ted, who wrote, in response to a problem, my mom said, Governor Kunin just started a governor's hotline. Maybe they can help us. It's Saturday afternoon, but we can probably leave a message. But when she dialed the number, she heard Governor's Hotline, Madeline speaking. So you were doing that live. You were doing it right there, answering people's questions live?
Once in a while.
Oh, that's wonderful. What a thrill that must have been. Let's go to the phones again. Tina is on the line from Lincoln. Hi, Tina.
Hi. This is very apropos because what I wanted to say, hello, Governor, and thank you so much for all you've done for Vermont. Was that I live in Lincoln, and one night there was a party for a Democratic person running for office, and I wanted to just walk up to this house because it was only about a half a mile from my house. So I walked up in the dark and arrived at this party, and there you were, Governor, and I was able to chat with you, and I just thought this wouldn't happen in any other state, only in Vermont.
Mm. Right.
It was
right.
So wonderful to feel like we can talk to our government appointees and governors and senators, and it's thank you so much. It's just great. I love living in this state, and I loved having you as a governor.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for calling.
Wonderful sentiment. Thank you for that call, Tina. We have Natalie on the line from Huntington. Hi, Natalie. You're on with Governor Kunin.
Hello, Governor Kunin.
Hello.
Thank you so much for your incredible governorship, your amazing leadership, and your decades of giving Vermont and the world the best in what leaders are and what they can do. You're quite the role model. Back in the early 90s, you held a rally. You were the speaker at a rally, and you had many speakers, and I was one of them. In support of the young women in Vermont, I worked for Step Up at the time, teaching carpentry. And I got on the steps and gave my little speech in my green hard hat. And I just wanted to thank you for your support of the young girls in Vermont, letting them know they can do anything. And that was a memorable time. So I really appreciate your years of service, and keep going. You continue on. We'll carry your spirit to deal with what we have here. We're going to figure a way out.
Thank you so much for calling. And you're right. We have to figure a way out and a way in to let our voices be heard.
Natalie, thank you very much for that phone call. Governor Kunin, I want to get to the sort of the elephant in the room, if you will. We are 1 week or so away from the results of the presidential election. And I know that you were hoping, of course, Hillary Clinton would become the first female president when she ran against Trump in 2016. I'm wondering how you felt about Kamala Harris's chances this time around in 2024. Did you think she was going to win?
Yes, I did think she was going to win. And I have to confess, I always hoped that I would live long enough to see a woman president, and that hope was shattered, as it was for so many of us. And my first reaction was not only the question of a woman, but the question of what kind of country we'd live in was being determined by this election. And I think your first reaction, at least that was mine, was sort of to crawl into a hole and ignore what was happening. But since then, I've started to get a broader perspective, and I think we have to be active. We have to be engaged to the extent that we can be, because if you crawl into a hole if you ignore what is happening. It's a form of acquiescence, as if we accept the status quo, and we can't accept things like millions of immigrants being kicked out of the country. There's so many things that Trump has promised, which he's going to fulfill his promise on. So even though it's hard, even though it seems impossible, we have to be engaged. And I read the diary of the Russian protester who died recently, and he had this incredible courage. So I think we have to figure out how we can respond. It's hard work. It's maybe thankless work, but we have to find a way within our capacity to stand up for democracy, to stand up for freedom.
That's Alexei Navalny, who you were just referring to, of course, who resisted Vladimir Putin and, yes, died recently. There is this kind of post-mortem going on right now in the Democratic Party to figure out what went wrong for Kamala Harris. Perhaps it's too soon to figure that out. I am curious if you have any strong opinions on why her candidacy failed.
No, I think the whole country kind of failed. The Democratic Party failed. We didn't read correctly the mood of the country. We thought it was accepting of things like more money for childcare and all the programs she proposed, but the country was still bruised and smitten by COVID, by inflation, and that was on people's minds. So we miscalculated, and she miscalculated, but that's where the Democrats were, and we've got to reconfigure the Democratic Party and figure out how to reach ordinary people, not just those who appear on TV, how to really respond to the needs of the populace in a helpful and clear way. So we've got a lot of work to do within the Democratic Party. And I think Kamala actually ran a stellar campaign. She didn't have to apologize about anything, and I was very proud of her. So she reflected where half the country was, but the other half went for Trump.
And, of course, Vermont went heavily for Harris. It was the first state to be called for her. But it's also true that more Vermonters voted for Trump in 2024 than either of the previous two times that he ran for president. What do you attribute that to? Is it just a microcosm of that national result you were talking about?
Yeah, I didn't know that till you mentioned it. But, it must have been a microcosm of the national mood. And we didn't capture that. I thought that the country would be disgusted by Trump's vulgarity and meanness, but I think they like strong leadership, and he's a macho man, and we're going to see how that plays out in the next 4 years. But even though I won't be alive to see it, I hope the country will turn to a strong woman leader in the future.
We got this email from Donna, who writes, Governor Kunin had much influence on getting more women involved in politics in Vermont. This is excellent. However, I attended a meeting featuring her and other Democratic women and found that their ideas were quite to the left of my own. I consider myself a centrist Democrat, writes Donna. I often wonder if the ideas expressed at that meeting were more fiscally conservative, if I might have gotten more involved in politics. Now, she says, I tend to split my vote, and I am looking for more moderate Democrats, independents, and Republicans when I vote. So what Donna's writing about there, Governor Kunin, this sort of wanting to have a more centrist kind of view, that's something that certainly Governor Phil Scott, the current governor, is pushing for. Do you think she has a kind of point there that, you know, because the Democrats, as you're saying, can go one way, they can maybe go hard left, like I think maybe Bernie Sanders would like to see? or try for a more centrist approach? Do you think there's a right way here?
I think we have to do a lot of talking and thinking and talking to people we don't usually talk to. So I think Donna's message is very appropriate. We have to be a little bit more centrist. I've advocated in my books for child care and those benefits. But we also have to find a way to stop the billionaires from having such an enormous influence on our politics and our elections. I think it's outrageous. Now I can't think of his name.
I think you're maybe thinking of Elon Musk. I'm trying to read your mind here, but yeah.
Elon Musk, he could buy votes, really. And so I don't see how that was legal at the time. We dismissed it, and he's going to have a big influence in the administration just because he's rich.
Yeah.
So that is not good for democracy either.
Yeah, well, he bought up one of the largest social media platforms in the country just because he could, and certainly we don't know if that's what spurred Trump to victory, but it obviously had some influence when you
yes.
have that kind of a platform and you can just buy it because you have that much money. Let's go back to the phone lines with Laurel on the line from Jericho. Hi, Laurel.
Hi. I am very thrilled to speak to both of you. Governor Kunin, you and I first spoke over 40 years ago when you referred me to Howard Dean to MC a fundraiser because Sandy and Caroline Payton, your neighbors from the northern Vermont area, had told me to call you. Over the years, we've crossed paths a few other times. You thrilled us all when you would buy my late husband's products at the Burlington Farmers Market, the It's Arthur's Fault sausage. But the thing that sticks with me the most is your book on feminism. And I've shared that with many women. I so appreciate it that you kind of called us on the carpet about dropping the ball.
Thank you so much for calling. And I'm trying to remember exactly where we met, but thank you for calling in and singing my praises, which may be deserved. I don't know.
These personal connections you have with listeners are really something, Governor. And Laurel, thank you very much for that call. I mentioned at the start of the program, Governor, that you were elected in 1984, a year when Republicans won the presidency by a far greater margin than Trump did this year. I'm not sure people remember that. In fact, the only state that Democrats won in 1984 was Walter Mondale's home state of Minnesota. The map was entirely red otherwise. 8 years later, though, things did change. Bill Clinton won the presidency. Democrats were suddenly no longer on the outside looking in. Do you see that as reason for hope for the Democratic Party? Or is that analogy not relevant given, you know, the uniqueness of the Trump presidency now, the fact that Republicans control the House and the Senate, and the Supreme Court has given near-blanket immunity to the powers of the presidency recently?
Well, no, I think absolutely that example may be correct. Things change very quickly in politics. We may even see a slight change in 2 years, not having to wait for 4 years, as the impact of Trump policies hit people and they feel it personally. So we have to have hope for the future. That's what this country is built on. The people have a voice, and we have to express our opinions and our fears and our hopes and our dreams, and they will have an impact. I mean, the important thing is for people to be engaged. I mean, the first response to bad news is you want to ignore it. And I watch less news than I used to before the election. And I console myself by reading poetry and just reading fiction. So we'll go through this mourning period, but then we have to wake up and be active.
And you write in your book, Coming of Age, about that very thing. You are a believer in protest, in activism, in getting out in the streets, and you still think that can help.
Yes. Silence will move us in the other direction. Silence is equivalent to acquiescence.
I think we have time for one more phone call. Let's go to Karen in Shelburne. Hi, Karen. You're on with former Governor Madeline Cunin.
Hi. Hello, Madeline. I've known you, of course, and admired you forever. I was looking out, as I look out at Shelburne Bay, I was remembering back many, many years ago when you and I both used to be out swimming in the early morning in the bay.
Yes.
And I remember telling my...
That was
lovely.
I
remember telling my... It was, except for the duck itch, but which you first warned me about. But I remembered telling my out-of-state friends that, you know, the governor and I were out swimming this morning, but commenting on how accessible government is and was in Vermont and how much I've always appreciated that. So thank you again.
Thank you for calling and having such a good memory and an appreciation of Vermont that we have the ability here in this state to have an impact.
I'm afraid to ask what the duck itch that she was talking about. Do you have any idea? But it sounds painful. Maybe we'll leave that one for another time.
Well, it's sometimes called swimmer's itch.
Oh, okay. All right. But I love the fact that you were out there swimming in the early late. I mean, what a wonderful thing to do, and maybe something else people can do now to deal with some of that despair you were talking about before. Get out in nature, appreciate what we have here in the state of Vermont.
Yes. Yes. On election day, the day after the election, a small group of us went to see the snow geese. And it was so beautiful and a wonderful sunset. And I thought, nature will heal us.
Governor Madeline Cunin, the first and to this date only woman governor of the state of Vermont, I want to thank you so much for your service. I want to thank you so much for the time. And I don't mean just for today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be on with you.